Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie of Reason TV. This is the Reason TV talk show with my co-host, Michael C. Moynihan. Our guests today are the Cato Institute trade policy analyst, Sally James, and former Reason DC editor and memoirist, Sam McDonald, who has a new book out called The Urban Hermit, which we'll talk about at length. A tale of weight loss and self-discovery. Mm.
Self-destruction, perhaps.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, that'll be the sequel.
Yeah.
Sally, we are rapidly nearing the end of 8 years of George Bush. What was his policy, or what's his legacy in terms of trade, and what are you looking for in the Obama regime?
His legacy on trade is a bit more mixed than his appalling legacy in so many other areas. He got off to a really bad start. He endorsed this terrible farm bill in 2002, signed it. He instituted steel tariffs in late 2001. So he got off to a bad start, then decided to launch the Doha round of multilateral trade negotiations. Now, it might not be my preferred way of getting to free trade. I'd prefer we do it unilaterally and yesterday, but it's a good way of getting there. And he has continued to push the Doha round. It's not going anywhere.
Doha is, yeah, I mean, it's just stuck in the sand, right?
Yes, but it's not necessarily because of Bush's actions. This time. He's also pushed other bilateral agreements between America and one other country.
He opened up America to the zombie workforce of the Dominican Republic, right?
That's true.
In the CAFTA
agreement. You got a problem with that?
No, not at all. No, I mean,
that's really anti-zombie.
I found it really funny that you know, many people who voted for NAFTA were like, "Oh, we can't enter into an agreement that has the Dominican Republic in it because our economy can't withstand the intense competition from a bunch of people, you know, zombies stitching baseballs."
Well, it's a powerhouse of zombies stitching baseballs. So I'm not necessarily a fan of those bilateral agreements, but at least he's tried to.
But you are objectively pro-zombie.
Isn't everyone?
Okay. What about Obama? Is he? He made very bad statements about trade throughout the primary process and the general election. But he's also got a lot of free market economist advisors.
Sure, but is he listening to them? I mean, he wasn't listening to them during the campaign.
Right.
I've heard that argument before, and I have some sympathy for it. But the statements during his campaign suggest he wasn't talking to them at all because they were distinctly anti-trade. He says,
now, what about this Canadian business? I mean, the Canadians, who was it? It was somebody within the Canadian government who had said to an American reporter that, hey, he's whispered to us in a backroom kind of thing, that don't just pay attention to what we do, not what we say.
That was Austin Goolsbee, one of his advisors, who said to a Canadian envoy, don't worry, it's just campaign rhetoric. That envoy then put it in a cable. The cable got leaked to the press. Now, I hope
it's
true.
Do people still use cables?
Sure. Yeah.
It wasn't an email?
No, cables. I've written them myself.
You've written a cable?
Sure.
Yeah.
When?
I used to work for the Australian Government Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade.
Well, but that's Australia. I mean, you guys are still
using cables.
We should point out that you have an accent, not a speech impediment. You are from Australia.
Yes, I work on it diligently.
Yeah.
So, we still use cables.
So you're still worried about Obama, though? Because there's no reason to believe that he does not, there's no reason to suspect that he doesn't believe his own rhetoric.
I would hope that, you know, during a campaign when you're trying to court, for example, organized labor, you might say things that you don't necessarily agree. Certainly when you get in office, you've got to take a more kind of big picture view, what's good for the country as a whole, not what's good for winning an election. So there's that. Today he's announcing his United States trade representative, a cabinet level appointment. It's going to be the former mayor of Houston. Right? And he was a huge champion of NAFTA. Of course, Texas has done very well on the McCandless objective, but it's done very well out of NAFTA. So that's, I guess, a positive move, although we don't know much about him. He's never held kind of federal office. He's never been a congressman. He's never had to vote for a trade agreement. But he seems to be a champion of free trade. But then, of course, the other appointment he's announcing today is the Labor Secretary, who's virulently kind of anti-trade, pro-Labor.
And who is that?
Hilda Solis, a Democratic congresswoman. And she came out against NAFTA, and, you know, so it does reveal, and the Wall Street Journal has an article today about this split within perhaps Obama's mind. He's kind of ambivalent on trade. I don't expect to see anything that will liberalise trade mm-hmm. necessarily out of this administration.
Does the worldwide economic panic, does that make it tougher to be a free trader? Do countries fall back into protectionist mode when they think the economy's going in the crapper?
There's that temptation. I mean, the G20 and their, you know, they had that thing in November where they got together and made a lovely statement about how we're going to resist protectionism, right. And then there was this mad rush to the exit as Russia increased tariffs on cars, India increased tariffs on steel. So there is that fear that in tough economic times they resort to protectionist measures because it looks like, that they're doing something and we're going to protect our industry from competition. You know, we know that's bunk, but they will try it. And that's what I'm concerned about with this administration. Right. There's not that kind of ideological commitment to keeping markets open even when times are tough.
Well, how would you say that free trade is, one of the top things in the past 30 years, or increased liberalized trade is one of the things that has really made everybody richer in the world?
I definitely think that's true. It's not necessarily visible, though. You know, if you see on a newspaper headline that 5,000 workers have lost their jobs, that's visible. If you see that 300 million Americans saved a dollar on a CD or something, that doesn't make news. So it's not necessarily something that captures the public's attention. I don't think it's something that's going to be very high up on this administration agenda at all. Mm. In fact, somebody who was offered the job rejected it on the grounds that it would not be high priority enough for him, trade. So that's not a good sign.
I hope that wasn't Lou Dobbs.
It was. It was Lou Dobbs. I didn't know that. Yeah.
Sam, tell us about the Urban Hermit.
The Urban Hermit, speaking of tough times, it's a book about my life right before I came to work for Reason Magazine, actually.
Right.
I graduated from Yale University in 1995. Spent most of my time there having a good time, which involved...
Chess matches.
Chess matches.
Chess matches. Wild turkey.
Sculling. Sculling us on.
It was... I had a lot of fun there. I did okay. I got extremely fat.
How fat?
I probably weighed about 215 when I went there, and I was in pretty good shape. I probably put on the freshman 50... Wow. I would say, okay, and then...
So you took it for your entire wing of the dorm. You were like, I'll take that back. You were trading permits for fatness.
I was, and I got very fat very quickly.
How'd you do that?
Drinking.
Really?
Yeah,
really?
Drinking, I drank a lot of beer, but not in...
What kind of beer?
You name it. Mostly cheap American yellow beer that you can see through. Sure. I don't like dark beer.
Me too.
Suspicious about it.
Yeah, I like it cold. So I drank a lot of beer, as cold as I could get it.
Then we're talking like Keystone, Hams,
Keystone.
Iron
we
City.
We drank a lot of Rolling Rock because it was cheap at the time, when it was still made in Latrobe, PA. So it was good, and I had a lot of fun. I didn't wreck any cars. I didn't fail out of college. I graduated with a double major. I had like a 3.2 or something marginally respectable.
But, I mean, there's great inflation at Yale, so that's really like
ton of
a
it.
Zero.
Yeah, so
at a competitive school?
I would say probably maybe like a C-plus or something. I did okay. So then,
so you got a beeraholics, gentleman C.
Yeah, I did. I would say I don't know if it was a gentleman's. I remember when I graduated, Master Bernard Litton handed me my diploma, and he said, "MacDonald, perhaps you could trade this in for a 6-pack."
Really?
And but
I don't need it. I
got plenty here. So I left. I moved to Baltimore, continued to gain even more weight. I drank a lot. I was a bouncer and I was a bartender. Mm-hmm. I drank. I lived sort of a But I was having so much fun. I just went completely broke. I ran out of money. I screwed up my taxes.
But you were working as a bouncer and then as a newspaper reporter?
Then as a newspaper reporter. After I went really broke and I got a job as a newspaper reporter.
You were hitting bottom.
I needed a job. And
what are you like? You're like 600 pounds at this point?
No, I would probably
about... What did you peak at? Because you didn't actually...
I never stood in a scale.
Yeah.
I probably peaked at
You hadn't seen your feet in like 6 years.
I was about 340 pounds, I'm guessing.
Okay. We're going to, when we come back, we're going to talk about your eating disorder that allowed you to lose the weight and become a shadow of your former self. And Sally will ask you about eating disorder down under. Because I understand there people throw up in a counterclockwise motion it's below the equator.
That is right. Yeah.
Bulimia on the
barbie.
We're going to take a break. Thank you very much.
The government bailed out Wall Street executives, homeowners, and struggling auto companies. But what about the rest of America?
I
I thought it would be a great way to save for our daughter's college fund.
You only get married once, so I threw myself a Sex and the City bachelorette party and bought Manolos for all of my bridesmaids, all 12 of them.
This African businessman sent me an email over the internet to my work account saying that he had an exciting business opportunity for the both of us. He said his name was Okunwe from Nigeria.
In trade, man. It is a money sucker. I thought Susan Lucci was a lock for another daytime Emmy. It'd been years.
All I had to do was wire him $50,000 into an American account, and then I'd get 60% of the inheritance. I didn't think twice about giving him my soch.
And then I had to fulfill one of my dreams as a bride and have Cavehead at my bachelorette party, which was amazing. I still get chills from it, but that was another 30 grand. Which is actually a pretty good deal because he usually costs more.
To make up for it, I quit my job and entered the World Series of Poker, but an injury prevented me from competing. A hangover's an injury.
Turns out it was a scam.
Where's my bailout?
Where's my bailout?
So, where's my bailout?
Contact your congressional representatives and ask them, where's my bailout? Because all Americans should be protected from their own stupidity.
Sam, when we stopped talking, you had ballooned up to 345 pounds, probably. You're not sure. Why did you say, you know, that's all I can take, so I can't take no more, as opposed to waiting until 400?
Mm-hmm. It really had nothing to do with weight.
What happened was I ran out of money. When you go to the bar 6 nights a week, 7 nights a week, and you're a newspaper reporter for a little weekly newspaper, the funds don't add up. So my car broke down. Then I screwed up my student loans, and I screwed up my taxes. This all happened in a week. Mm-hmm. So I went from living a paycheck to paycheck existence to being just thousands of dollars in debt, all due a long time ago. Mm-hmm. So,
where's your bailout?
Where was my bailout?
I'm thinking, though, if you're 345 pounds, you're too big to fail.
You are too big.
I was Well, I failed. What I did was, I just was curious, and I thought, I wonder how much money I'm wasting. Because, I wasn't making a ton of money. People live as reporters.
Sure.
So I thought, why am I this broke? So I came up with this plan to live on as little as possible for a month. That ended up being 800 calories a day, mostly in the form of lentils. I would not go out. I wouldn't go to any movies. I wouldn't buy any books. No magazines. Just nothing. So I lived on lentils and tuna fish. I did it for a month. And then you bastard, you gave me an assignment to go.
I am like a strange, shadowy figure in this book.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah, Nick is in the book.
And I had
as Nick? Okay,
yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So
I am a master of disguise, so I actually appear in different guises throughout the book and lead him through the forest of Lochigan as a wizard.
So what happened was I was so bored that I started just working more over the course of this month because I couldn't go out for coffee. I started pitching magazine stories.
I've lost weight since I've been here. I'm bored. I only eat lentils.
Broke.
Broke.
My student loans tripled.
Yeah. You're all aware of what I went through then because Jesse Walker actually responded to me and said, we're interested in the story. It was a story about going to live with these hippies in Montana. And I was going to write about it from the standpoint of spontaneous order. So he assigned that story, but
By the way, if Hayek had ever met a hippie, he would have become a Marxist.
Yeah, I think so, too. Yeah. I almost did when I went out there. So I got the story to go to the Rainbow Gathering.
Yeah.
Right around the same time, my editor from the little weekly newspaper said, you're going to Bosnia with the National Guard. So I needed some cash in my pocket for that as well.
So this was in a time in American journalism history where small weeklies outside of Baltimore would send you to Bosnia?
What happened was our National Guard unit went there from Laurel, Maryland.
It was a small Serbian weekly. in Baltimore.
And what happened was the National Guard called up, and this is one of those press junket things. They said, you know, your local guys are going there. You want to hop on a C-130 and go over? And I thought, sure, it's better than covering city council. So I went to, but I needed some money in my pocket. So I was just coming out of this month where I probably lost about 30 pounds living on lentils, but I was completely broke because I sent all the money to the creditors, and I thought, well, I need money for drugs to go to Montana and for just to get to Bosnia. So I went through all this. So I had to do it for another month to get more money in my pocket. Then I came back, and my car broke again. Just one financial calamity after another, and I bailed myself out just by not spending any money on anything ever. And I ended
up
losing.
Only they could lose that learn that lesson in Washington.
Yeah, and now you and then you met your wife while you were going through this lentil-induced diet. Did you have any, one of the things that's very fun about the book are the descriptions of the hunger pangs and things like that. Did you have hallucinations? I'm still getting a contact high off you from that. But that is a radical shift to go from being a fat shit and obviously eating and drinking all of the time to cutting
to 800. So you're so sensitive,
Nick. No, I'm just saying.
Clearly it was a fat shit.
I prefer fat bastard.
Yeah. Okay.
But it was not so much the physical hunger. That was problematic, and that was... That sucked a lot.
It was the hunger of the soul.
Not even so much the hunger of the soul. It was the hunger of my, my weekly calendar. I mean, I didn't have anything to do. My friends drank. I couldn't go to the bar. I was bored. The boredom of living in America and not spending a single dime on anything. It sucks. Like, I couldn't go get magazines. I guess I could have gone to the library.
Yeah.
But I didn't even know where the library was. I mean, I'm an American. I buy books. I don't...
You're a Yale grad.
You don't know that. A huge fat drunk, too. Yes. Probably. Actually, huge fat drunks usually know where the library is because usually sleeping in the stacks.
Yeah.
Sally, did you ever go through a period where you... I mean, other than the current one where you just gained a ton of weight.
Well, I can't what?
Where you gained a ton of weight.
Actually, I gained a ton of weight just moving to America,
it's the land of junk food, and it's
fantastic.
Yeah. Have you ever traveled through the buffet belt in America, which pretty much encompasses the entire lower 48 states now?
But I'd like to. There is
a huge swath through the South.
The Golden Corral belt.
Cactus Willie's?
Cactus Willie's. Never heard of that.
Oh, awesome. That sounds good.
Sounds fascinating.
No, I love small town America. And if that coincides with the buffet belt, I have to get
it. It was
there.
Whoever mass merchandise sweatpants. I mean, it was like, because even mobsters now don't try to, keep their guts in there, just wearing tracksuits all the time.
Yeah.
It's me.
I'm a fan of the tracksuit now.
Yeah.
I'm still not much heavier. I'm still probably 15 pounds heavier than what I was when I was living in Australia.
What is Australia getting fatter like America is?
Yes.
I mean, this is the delivery, isn't it, on enlightenment progress that we can all, no matter how rich or poor, we can all be fat slobs like Henry VIII.
Yeah.
It's fat... In a democratic sense.
It is, it's the ultimate leveler, right? Yeah. We thought death was the ultimate leveler, where it's really just a Golden Corral.
I had to explain this when living in Europe for 5 years, of the issue of fat Americans always came up for some reason. Mm-hmm. And I would always explain that you're 5 years behind us. Just wait 5 to 8 years. And that is the case now in Sweden, not so much, but in England, in Scotland, which are the fattest people in the universe. And they're like, you Americans are so fat. And there's like somebody who's like 9,000 pounds telling you this, sweating haggis. It's like, it's coming.
Whole pieces of haggis. Stomach.
It's really disgusting.
So, Sam, where did you get the inner resolve? I mean, in a way, I guess it makes sense, because actually to be that fat or to drink that much every night, that takes an enormous amount of... But it takes
it's like
Bismarck. I mean, you are the Iron Chancellor or something to get out
like
every day and do that.
Without any power.
The thing is, I never lost my job. I went to work every day, and I performed pretty well. But I was the fattest, drunkest guy at the bar for a long time. I starred in the bar's commercial. They made a commercial for the bar in Baltimore.
Do you want to give a plug? Is it still around?
Kissling's Tavern.
Which, do you have a copy of this commercial, by the way?
Is it on YouTube?
The bastards at Kissling's keep on sending me videotapes telling me that it's on it. But it keeps on being the wrong videotape. I think that they're still drinking there. Yeah, I don't think they ever bailed themselves out in the way that I did.
So what do you do now? What's your plan? Do you have...
Ask my wife. I teach creative writing at the University of Pittsburgh. I teach journalism, composition. The book just came out, so we're in the process of doing publicity for that. But some combination of
teaching.
Are you
going to go on an eating tour? Because that would be pretty
I'll
great.
Go with you.
But go around and eat, you know, sell the book at a buffet restaurant.
Yeah. One of the reasons that this could never have worked, I don't think, as a diet book, which is really not a diet book, is because diet books typically are, it's not your fault, you don't have to be hungry. Yeah. Mine says, it is your fault, you do have to be hungry.
Yeah. You're a fat shit.
You're a fat slob. Stop being such a fat jerk and you'll lose a bunch of weight.
I have to say, you know, one of the things, because Sam, you worked at Reason from, it was like 2000, through the, basically 2001 to beginning of 2002, I think it was, or thereabouts, and he covered 9/11. He was in D.C. the day of 9/11. I think the first thing we posted about 9/11 was written by Sam, which is all available at Reason online, Reason.com. But I had no idea until I got this, the galleys of the Urban Hermit, that you have been living this bizarre life as a formerly fat shit.
I thought that you knew that.
No, I had no idea.
I must have told you about the shit part.
And it's funny because throughout the book, the real star of the piece is that he's constantly waiting on this paltry check from Reason for the Rainbow Gathering story piece. Like, oh, you know, when I get that, then everything's going to be okay. And it's like, you know, that really
does Nick come across as kind of a dick in the book, by the way? Is he like this dickish figure that is giving you like breadcrumbs?
Immensely so, I think.
Okay, good. Sally, I have one final thing, and you knew it was going to come up. Can you explain to Reason TV viewers, all of them, the legions of Reason TV viewers, how it came to pass that the singer from Midnight Oil is now Australia's Minister of the Environment? Is that is correct, right?
No, that's
Peter Garrett.
Peter Garrett, that's right. Same way Jesse Ventura became whatever he was.
So you really are following the path
of
America. Absolutely.
No, but I mean, but Garrett is much more, I mean, he's in a national office, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a federal minister. He's, you know, he's always been very political. Midnight Oil songs are always unashamedly political.
The time has come to say face fair.
You that's always do that.
My best part.
Should the Australians sleep while their beds are running? And
that's
the
why
world is turning.
he's a celebrity and he's always been very political. Yeah. And
he's a total communist too, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a commie.
Yeah, okay.
Loosely defined.
Loosely defined, in the Australian way.
Is Australia getting better or worse? Like, why did you move here? Did you leave because you're like, you know, this country is going down the tubes? Last one off is a didgeridoo.
I didn't so much leave Australia as come to America. In other words, it wasn't a negative move.
I thought you were going to say Australia left you.
No, absolutely not. No. I'm very Australian. No, it was. I got offered a job at the Cato Institute, which I'd always admired, and I love America, and I thought it would be a great move. I was working for the Australian government at the time, although in a good pro-trade office. And I just
This is a John Howard administration?
This is the John Howard administration, and which was pretty pro-trade. And I got offered the job, and I thought, I'll take it. I've got nothing to lose. Life's a big adventure, and I've been here 2.5 years, and I love it.
Is your American experiment going well?
It's going well. I really love it here. I miss home. I miss friends and family, and there's definitely cultural distinctions, even though we both...
For instance, we
English,
think so that Paul Hogan is a hilarious movie star.
Oh, I don't know about that. Although he is
and we rejected Yahoo Serious when he tried to come to.
And Jacko, Mark Jackson. Is Jacko? He's the Prime Minister of Australia.
He is the Prime Minister now. Yeah,
with Peter Garrett and
And then the bass player for Midnight Oil is the Minister of Defense or something. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we will go now, and we'll. Can we play an Andy Gibb song just to end this?
On the way out,
sure.
We can do that in post production.
Thank you very much for Reason TV. I'm Nick Gillespie, and my co-host is Michael C. Moynihan. And I want to thank Sally James, a trade policy analyst at the Cato Institute, and Sam McDonald, a former Reason DC editor and the author of the excellent new memoir, The Urban Hermit. Thank you all.